Wesley Financial Group is not a law firm.
Are you a victim of the timeshare trap and think there's no way out? I'm Chuck McDowell, founder of Wesley Financial Group, and I'm here to tell you that there is a way out. I will send you a timeshare exit information kit absolutely free, explaining how the timeshare industry works and your options for cancellation.
Get the facts. For your free timeshare exit info kit, go to iCancelTimeshare.com. That's iCancelTimeshare.com. iCancelTimeshare.com.
Listener, today's episode has a partial focus on Santeria. In many ways, Santeria is the Cuban version of voodoo. They share a similar origin story. Instead, with Santeria, slaves were brought from West Africa to Cuba. There, just like with voodoo, the enslaved were forced to convert to Catholicism. And from there, a fusion of religions created Santeria. Though similar, there are differences. As mentioned, voodoo was influenced by French-American culture, whereas Santeria was fostered by Cuban and Mexican cultures. Like voodoo, Santeria has a rich history that is worth exploring and is also misunderstood and unfortunately has been negatively affected by its portrayals. In 1987, a horror film called The Believers, featuring actor Martin Sheen, with a portrayal of Santeria that was offensive even for its time.
He's about to discover that the real horror is just beginning.
Maria! Don't you come any closer!
You see what they did to the kid in there?
You said he found a body on an altar with a lot of religious paraphernalia, right?
A religion as old as time.
One life from each of us counts.
Versus an unimaginable force for evil.
This ritual's being performed now.
One life is all he has.
Nothing can stop them.
It's a power you can't imagine.
Want them to know who you are? Do you?
What have they done to you, Sean?
In today's episode, we take a look at what is maybe one of the most bizarre cases I've covered. I'm tempted to hint at what is to come, but I think it's best to let things play out on its own. Now, let's get on with it.
Welcome, listener. I'm glad you're here. Take a seat next to the fire.
Welcome to Obscura, where we shine a light on the dark.
Quote, in the 19 years I've been with the department, this is probably the most bizarre case I've ever experienced. Douglas County Sheriff Larry McDonald. Mark dances as instructed. The chanting and beating of the drums take the place of his thinking. The dance is simple. Just a few steps, but he watches his feet as he moves them and swivels his arms. He's dressed in all white. At first, the dancing was light, but slowly, it's grown more rigorous. Before he realizes what's being handed to him, he's grasping a machete. Without being told what to do with the blade, Mark begins to dance wildly, swinging the blade around him. When he slows, two dancers stop and grab his arms. Standing by his side, he's walked around the room in circles. He can hear clapping. Mark wonders if it's finally happened, if he's found what he searched for so many years, the spiritual awakening he has sought for so many years. The dancing is finished. He didn't know it before, but his white clothes are soaked with sweat. Mark is ushered into a tub filled with water and herbs necklaces are held out in front of him, and it takes a moment to realize he's supposed to pick one. He chooses. The man holding the necklace mumbles, "Eshu, trickster." He then submerges the necklace into the water and herbs. The man notices Mark's look of confusion, and he responds, "Holy water." Mark is told to kneel, his head then submerged in water. He's been baptized. When Mark comes up, gasping for air, herbs are being rubbed into his skin. He knows from within, he is now a new person. Part 1. A Family Man. The 1970s through 80s. After high school, Mark joined the Air Force. From the Air Force, he grows a taste for travel and eventually finds himself in New Orleans. There, he is initiated into Santeria. Finished with the Air Force, Mark becomes a pharmacist. And at some point after, Mark marries and together, he and his wife have children. The common feeling among Mark's children is that he makes them feel loved. Though, Mark can be a little off the wall. It's not uncommon for Mark to give the children palm or tarot card readings. When he does, most of the family just consider it a joke. They have a little laugh, something to look at lightheartedly, and move on. He's also the adoptive father of his nephew, Brent Thompson. Brent's mother died when he was just a child. From the outset, he and his uncle shared a special bond. From the moment he arrived, Mark went out of his way to make him feel part of the family. Whether it was family outings or family vacations, he became an integral part of the household straight away. Mark himself is a hobbyist and dabbler. Which hobby depends on the week. I say that as a dabbler myself. And, like myself, it's not uncommon for Mark to spend hundreds, if not thousands, on a hobby, only to move on to another one shortly after. A nearby storage garage acts as a graveyard for Mark's dead interests. Mark and his family have settled in Minneapolis, Minnesota. From the 1920s through 1950s, Minneapolis was considered one of the most bigoted cities in the U.S., with a strong presence by the Ku Klux Klan and the anti-Semitic hate group Silver Legion of America. But in present day, Minneapolis is known for having one of the largest LGBT populations in the states, as well as a thriving hip-hop and rap scene. The neighborhood the Fosters live in is deeply religious. The Fosters fit in, and they themselves attend a Seventh-day Adventist church. Mark's wife and children seem satisfied with the church, but Mark has beliefs that span across the spiritual spectrum. It's not uncommon for friends to be invited to see some new religious effigy Mark has acquired. Beside his continually growing collection of religious figures, Mark hides from those in the neighborhood his strong belief in Santeria and all the little practices and ceremonies he performs in privacy. At his Aleki necklace initiation, Mark was given the Orisha Eshu. Eshu is a trickster Orisha. To quote Reverend Dr. E of SantariaChurch.org, Eshus are found everywhere in the wild, and each is different from the others. Eshus are wild and uncontrollable by nature. Messing with one without the proper respect will get you in big trouble quickly, as it is the nature of Eshu to cause problems, test humanity, and upset the balance of things. To put it bluntly, Eshu is a god of chaos, but it's also believed in Santeria that he can be used as a tool for gain. Mark takes this to heart, and many of Mark's life decisions would be formed by this perceived knowledge of Eshu. Mark was guided by Eshu, It was a symbol. It meant so much to him. And it brought him to the crossroads. Part 2. The Crossroads. The early 1990s. One of these decisions is to start his own electronic library service called Quanta Press in 1989. The foster home was always full of computers. It was another one of Mark's many hobbies. Mark was into computer networking long before your average person even saw a home computer in person. Mark takes freely available information from the U.S. government and burns it to CD-ROM. He figured he may lose money on the venture, but hey, it's worth a shot. It's not long after the business has started that he sees major profit, far more than he could have ever expected. It's a life-changing, staggering amount of money. He's soon burning atlases to CD-ROM for less than $1, and then selling them for $130. In Mark's mind, he has Eshoo to thank. It doesn't take long for the money to go to his head. With a seemingly endless supply of cash, women quickly become a focal point of his life. He soon divorces his first wife, remarries, then divorces his second wife as well. His third wife is an employee of Quanta Press. I'm not sure that one would fly in 2024. Mark chooses a cow as the logo for Quanta Press. Unlike many of his obsessions, Mark has a long-time obsession with bovine art, cows being one of his longest obsessions, second only to Santeria. He explains to friends and family that the cow represents the fact that the tech industry is a cash cow business. In 1993, a newly seated vice president, Al Gore, is known as an Atari Democrat.
These are computer disks, and a federal employee on his own initiative went out and bought these at a discount store. He bought a packet of 10 for $10.99 and got a coupon giving a $2 discount for the next order of 10. In the centralized procurement system, the same exact package costs $11.37 without the coupon.
He has an obsession with the development of technology and believes it could lead to stimulating the economy. Predating the dot-com boom, media outlets landing on Atari as their idea of technology really gives you an idea of how the U.S. was dragging its knuckles in technological R&D. Gore goes on a tour through the United States to promote his Atari Democrat worldview, and eventually even has a photo app with our man, Mark Foster. It's interesting to think that Al Gore stood next to a future Santeria spiritual master. Of course, to Al Gore, this is just another photo op on his tour. Now, not only making a considerable amount of cash, Mark Foster's company, Quantum Press, is in the public eye. A side effect of his newly acquired success, Mark quickly becomes reckless in company spending. To some, he can be seen as a perfect boss. It's not unlike him to shut the office down for the day and take his employees out for dinner and a movie. Mark also grows obsessed with limousines, often taking friends and employees out for the night, on the town, hitting as many bars before closing time as they could. Caught up in his own ego, Mark and his company fails to change with the times. Mark has ceased being an innovator. He's completely out of touch. What started as a ludicrous source of income slowly becomes a major loss of profit. Overnight, Mark is left worse off than he was before. As it turns out, during even the highest points in profit, Mark was spending more money than he was taking in. All those days buying out the bars, the women, expensive cars, it all added up to one thing: staggering debt. With the company folding, Mark's debt increasing, and Mark becoming increasingly irritable, Mark's third wife leaves him. He goes from the type of boss that's friends with the whole office to screaming and yelling at his employees. He feels that they've been disorganized, that their priorities haven't been straight. It's clear to those around him that he's becoming unraveled, unhinged. It appears that Mark is incapable of taking personal responsibility for any of the mistakes made by his company. Soon after, it dawns on Mark that he's been losing touch with his spirituality. Mark needs to be reborn. Again, it's clear to Mark that he's failed to utilize a shoe. Mark Foster needs a change. He knows he has left his spiritual beliefs to decay in favor of the physical world. Mark takes a plane back to New Orleans, to the location where he was first reborn. He decides to leave his Santeria priesthood, also known as the Santero, behind, and become a Babalawos. Babalawo see the future of their clients through communication with Ifa. This allows Mark to obtain the role of Supreme Being, at least a Midwestern Supreme Being. To do so, he must symbolically kill the high priest who initiated him. But, listener, this is where things get muddy. According to some of Mark's former disciples, there was no symbolism involved, and Mark literally killed the man who initiated him. This can only be speculated on, as there is no evidence that proves or contradicts this information. Part 3. Lord of the Crossroads, the mid-90s. Quote, Mr. Foster saw him one day at a bookstore and kind of focused on him, brought him into his cult. When he returns to Minneapolis, Mark soon realizes he's a leader without a flock, but he's not sure exactly where or how to recruit others into Santeria. After giving it some thought, he figures a bookstore is as good as any place. People purchasing books would be seeking knowledge, and unlike at a library, they were likely to have money. Like something out of a comedy, Mark Foster hangs around an occult bookstore looking for potential members to be initiated into Santeria. I can just imagine him in a brown trench coat and suspicious hat, big black shades, pretending to read while watching concerned bookstore patrons. One day, a young and confused Greg Freisner is spotted by Mark browsing the occult books when he approaches him. Greg is the perfect target for Mark. He's described by his mother as never shy, outgoing, and curious about everything. And once he sinks his teeth into something, that's it. He goes for it. Greg is the rough and tough type. He's into metal, is always seen in black. He often sports facial hair, a stern look, and a cigarette in old photos. Personality-wise, aside from being curious about everything, like Mark, Greg is a very stubborn person. After a blowout fight with his mother, he's off to Minneapolis. Mark brings him under his wing immediately. Mark's first disciple as a supreme being. It's easy to suggest he's likely a father figure to Mark as well. At that age, young, angry, confused, sometimes just being accepted for who you are is enough. I'm not implicating Greg's parents in any of this. It's just that a little acceptance can go a long way. Just like Mark, Greg finds that his life purpose is to serve a shoe. Even in debt, Mark continues to obsess over women. What starts as practicing traditional Santeria slowly shifts into Mark running a sex cult. With these cults, it always comes back to sex, doesn't it? Mark starts incorporating tantric sex rituals, or neo-tantra, into his cult rituals, a fusion of Mark's own creation. The type of pop tantra has become increasingly popular since the 1960s, and was foisted further into unfathomable popularity by celebrities like Tom Hanks and Sting. but many have been critical of the use of tantric sex to explore Tantra. German author and Indologist wrote in an essay critical of pomp Tantra. California Tantra is based on a profound misunderstanding of the tantric path. Their main error is to confuse tantric bliss with ordinary orgasmic pleasure. To put it bluntly, Mark begins using the authority as leader of his disciples to demand sexual favors from the women. Tantric sex rituals are just another tool he uses to get his way. To quote Brent Thompson, "Tantric sex was just another thing my uncle was involved in, where typically a man and woman seek enlightenment through sexual prowess. But honestly, the main draw was just the sex. The women in his cult would do anything for you. They were used for sexuality and pleasure, and that was a big draw to get people into the cult." Despite his reconnection to his spirituality and tantric sexual escapades, Mark's company folds. One day he's found in his closet with a gun to his head. After being talked down, he's hospitalized and diagnosed with depression. After being released, Mark has to come to terms with a new reality. He's flat broke. Actually, broke would be an improvement. He's severely in debt. Mark begins to live out of dingy motels meant for 30-minute stays with Backpage escorts. It's quite the downgrade from buying the bar out and palling around the city in a limo.
Your Honor, I'd like to present to the ladies and gentlemen of the jury with Exhibit B, a bag of Sweet Tango apples.
Boy, these apples are delicious.
And zesty, and sweet.
Best I ever tasted.
Your Honor, I object.
Overruled. Court dismissed. We need to recess to the grocery store for some Sweet Tango apples.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at sweettango.com.
Even being down on his luck, Mark still seems to have a way with women. He eventually finds his fourth wife and the sister of his third. His new wife, Sarah Phillips Foster, has a child from an ex who's known to be violent. Mark and his followers decide to deal with the ex the only way they know how, with spooky spells. Five disciples meet at a cemetery to use a person's grave as an altar for a hex. They then manipulate three initiates into being vessels for the hex. Whether you believe in Santeria or not, it's worth noting that those that performed the ritual did, meaning they were intentionally trying to hurt someone with their ritual. I don't believe that you could defend this type of ceremony morally. Intent does matter, after all. This was an attempt to use the powers of their religion to commit evil, an attempt at black magic. And it doesn't stop there. Among top members of the cult, in hushed whispers when initiates aren't around, sacrifice is brought into the discussion. It becomes a serious consideration to find a black girl, raping her, killing her in a ritual sacrifice, and then burying her. The atmosphere in the cult goes from being free-spirited and driven by tantric sex to paranoid and shrouded in darkness. With murder on the table, it seems there is no going back. Those closest to Mark are knee-deep in the same muck he finds himself in. So, he continues the downward spiral. Part 4. The Muck. July 18th, 1997, Wisconsin. The three men rode in nervous silence. Only two would come home. They knew what needed to be done, but this would be a true test for their beliefs. It is one thing to practice voodoo. It's another when a person's life is on the line. The scene is surreal. Three men in a car, all in ceremonial robes. For Mark, there is no turning back. The IRS want just short of $3 million. $3 million, listener, he doesn't have. There's an ongoing child pornography investigation. Besides, the preparations have been made. Those closest to him will receive large insurance payouts. He's written letters to his lawyers, attempting to frame Sarah Phillips Foster's ex as the killer, as well as slipping a note in his boot implicating the ex. He's written his own obituary, and of course, he's recorded a final goodbye tape for the children.
Sometimes we may need to call on the help of what the Africans call the Rishas, the spirits. The Africans believe that this life is a party. In order to go home, we have to get our party right, or at least we have to strive to get that party right. We celebrate life as we celebrate death. Death is nothing to be afraid of. Death is a great crossroads, a change in attitude, a change in longitude, a change in the way that we perceive our spirit. When we reach that portal, they'll ring some golden bells.
The men make a stop by the storage unit. Mark gets out of the car and walks off as a strange figure in his white robe. He returns holding the .44 caliber Magnum rifle. The plan is as follows. Mark will be shot by Greg, his highest ranking disciple. As Mark dies, Eshu will then transfer Mark's spirit to Greg's body. It took some convincing. Even for those that truly believed in Mark's version of Santeria, it's difficult to talk a close friend into executing you. But Mark has always been good with words. He explains that instead of sacrificing himself, he could always use Greg or his nephew Brent as the sacrifice to improve the group's fortune. This was enough to convince them that Mark is the right choice. You have to wonder if even Mark believed the plan would work. It wasn't long before that he was found in a closet with a gun to his head. It makes it that much more difficult to know his motives, as Mark was always playing mind games, an agent of chaos. Say what you want about the man, his life, the people he took advantage of, the evil he committed. He really did take to modeling his life after Eshu, seriously. Up until the very end, I asked myself, and I ask you, listener, what do you think those final hours were like? Did they talk before the execution? Were their stories shared about the good times, when the money was flowing, the women were plentiful, the sound of rolling tires on that last winding road, before Mark made his final ritual sacrifice, gave his last breath? When they arrived at the destination in northwestern Wisconsin, things became mechanical. Greg dressed himself head to toe in rubber and donned a gas mask. This was to prevent blood spatter. Mark grabbed the rifle and the men walked off to the edge of the tree line. Mark then cocked the rifle and handed it to Greg. Greg lifted the gun, but hesitated. Mark grabbed the barrel of the gun and pointed it to his chest, directly over his heart. There again was hesitation. Mark nodded. Greg pulled the trigger, and the gun didn't fire. Mark's last prank as the trickster. Mark took the gun, he chambered the bullet, and handed it back to Greg. Greg again pulled the trigger, and, listener, Greg Friesner, believe it or not, is not inhabited by the soul of his dead friend. He's left to stand staring at Mark writhing on the ground in a blood-stained white robe. Mark manages to gasp, "No, it's not me. This isn't me. It's not happening," before dying. Back in the car, Greg and Brent spent some time sobbing before leaving Mark Foster's dead body behind.
The murder of Twin Cities pharmacist Mark Foster initially baffled investigators in Wisconsin. His body was found along a country road in Douglas County, 45 miles from Superior, Wisconsin. Foster was found shot to death July 19th, less than 12 hours after leaving his home to meet some friends. But now, a bizarre twist. Minneapolis police and Wisconsin investigators executed a search warrant this week at Foster's Minneapolis home. According to a search warrant affidavit, Foster was a member of a religious cult involved in voodoo. He believed he was going to die and that his soul would be transferred to the one who killed him. A note found in Foster's shoe and other witnesses have named cult members as possible suspects in the shooting murder of Foster. The search warrant indicates that police believe their prime suspect or suspects live in Foster's home and could include his wife and several cult members. A man who came to the door at the home today says he lives with the family but wouldn't comment about the murder.
Is there anything at all you can tell me? Just about what's going on?
The police have just asked us not to talk to the press.
But police are telling us they have reason to believe Foster may have orchestrated his own murder. Evidence seized from his home includes a videotape of Foster saying goodbye and singing and waving, several voodoo books and diaries, and a $300,000 life insurance policy he recently purchased.
Investigators quickly learned the gun used to kill Mark Foster was likely his own. The security log at Mark's storage unit shows that he entered the unit at 4:36 p.m. on July 17, 1997. The manager of the unit identified Foster's car entering the lot on the security videotape on the same day. Sarah put in a claim for the insurance money amounting to $200,000, which initiated an investigation by the insurance company, which only helped hasten the investigation. It's quickly learned that Mark put in for $300,000 with another insurance company as well. Eventually, Mark Foster's goodbye tape to his wife, children, and unborn child is soon found. In the tape, Mark expresses his excitement for the long journey he's going to take. He discusses visiting old ancestors and since past relatives. Finally, he played religious songs on various instruments, including a harmonica. It's not until 2002 that Brent Thompson and Greg Friesner are charged. Greg pleads guilty to second-degree murder. He's given 10 years. Brent came clean for his role in Mark Foster's death and was given a plea agreement. Both Mark Foster's sister and daughter asked for leniency in Brent's sentencing. Mark's daughter, Angela Foster, stood up in court and told the judge, "I know that he would have done just about anything my father asked him to do. I know my father was real sick." Angela explains to the judge that she lost her father in northwestern Wisconsin all those years ago. She didn't want to now lose her cousin to prison. Brent is given 3 years for his role in Mark Foster's death.
Make the right call for the right Medicare Advantage benefits. Go to MedMutual.com/review to schedule your free Medicare plan review with Medical Mutual, Ohio's hometown Medicare insurer.
Your Honor, I'd like to present to the ladies and gentlemen of the jury with Exhibit B, a bag of Sweet Tango apples.
Mmm, boy, these apples are delicious.
And zesty? Mmm, and sweet.
Best I ever tasted.
Your Honor, I object.
Overruled. Court dismissed. We need to recess to the grocery store for some Sweet Tango apples.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at SweetTango.com.